man just disappeared. I mean, one minute he was there, and then he was just gone.
I saw a creature standing there in the woods, and it was big and hairy.
And we looked up, and there was this light in the sky, and it was so weird. I didn't know what to make of it.
I had a dream that came true, and it saved my life.
From the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains, this is Speaking of Strange with Joshua P. Warren, the show that explores today's mysteries and the groundbreaking knowledge of tomorrow. It's live from Asheville, North Carolina, and tonight, all the mysteries of psychic phenomena will be demonstrated not only before you, but with you. Yes, I want you to participate in some of tonight's activities. To those of you in the Southeast and around the globe on the Internet, welcome to the region's top-rated Saturday night talk program that gives you breaking news and insight regarding the paranormal and downright weird, where the unusual becomes usual. And we don't just discuss it, we go in the field to investigate. It is June 13th, 2009, on this date in, you know what? I don't even know what happened on this date a few years. Forrest, what happened June 13th? Sometime
June
in history.
June 13th, 2009, Ahmad Demijad was confirmed as the current and still running leader of Iraq.
There we go. There's some history for you. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, author of books like Haunted Asheville and How to Hunt Ghosts, and president of Lemur Paranormal Investigations. Obviously, you already see the legendary Forrest Connor is my producer and engineer tonight. Good evening, Forrest.
Good evening, Joshua.
And it's an extra special evening because also Micah Hanks is here, one of the original Montauk Boys. In the flesh. Good evening, Micah.
You know, the great beast, when he lived in North New York there, used to hang around Montauk Point and meditate. You look very Crowley-esque yourself tonight, Josh, and good to be here with you. With all y'all.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I feel sinister enough to fit that bill. And, you know, tonight we are going to have just an extra special show because we not only are going to dig into experiments regarding psychic phenomena that listeners can participate in, that both of you will be participating in, but we're also going to talk with Ed Grimsley. Of course, he's coming to Asheville. He'll be here in a matter of days. We're going to touch base with him about the latest in his UFO research. And also, psychic Angela Moore is going to join us. You may know her as the Hillbilly Psychic. And she's going to describe what's happening in this crazy world today. And we'll also take your phone calls with your questions. We have her website, angela-moore.com, linked up at speakingofstrange.com. And check out her blog. You know, she really keeps on top of that blog, updates it with good stuff. So I'm going to ask her about some of the things happening in the world today. And, you know, we're also going to sort of use that to lead up to some of these psychic experiments. And also, we are going to give you an exclusive breaking news on news from Lemur experiments that we've done in our new lab. And yes, we've been talking about it for a long time. At long last, breaking news from the Lemur lab. I'm a little bit distracted here in the studio for a number of reasons. I just drank one of those six-hour energy drinks, so I can just flip out on the air tonight. And yet, I've never done this. This is the first time I've ever taken a six-hour energy drink and just gulped it down. I had to get up really early this morning because
What is early for you, Mr. Warren?
I was doing experiments till 6 in the morning, and then I got up maybe like four hours later, and I had to
go.
So
you got up at 10 this morning.
Yeah, something like that. And I attended a Catholic wedding at Basilica of St. Lawrence, a Catholic wedding. Have you ever been to a Catholic wedding, Forrest?
I have not.
I've been to several of them before, and I tell you, today at this particular wedding, there were babies just hanging off of the rafters. They were doing backflips. They were pounding on the walls. They were screaming. And, of course, as all this is happening, as all of these babies are just raising holy hell throughout this entire wedding, the minister is up there saying, "We hope that you will flourish and be fruitful and bring forth more babies into the world, and you will raise them as good Catholics." And I'm thinking, no, please, no. We have enough babies. The Catholics love the idea of being fruitful.
Well, as I recall, I was attended your wedding a couple years ago. Did they not say the same thing in your wedding?
No. My wedding ceremony was conducted by Micah's father, who is the Padre Hanks. And no, Padre Hanks said nothing about needing to bring more babies into the world. Right, Micah?
Well, he raised me.
And so that he understands the problems that arise then from being fruitful and multiplying. Well, you know, Micah, here's one thing that I find interesting about you. Anybody who knows much about you personally knows that you are a musician. You play solo. You also go out with bands. I mean, you always have gigs all over creation. And I'm sure you played at a lot of weddings, right?
Oh, yeah.
In fact, you and your father and brother played at the wedding reception for me and Lauren. In fact, you even did some acoustic guitar sort of before and after our actual wedding ceremony. How many weddings do you think that you have seen as a man who actually makes money in some capacity by attending weddings?
That's a good question.
Many, huh?
Yeah, a lot. I can't. I couldn't tell you how many weddings I've been to. They've all been wonderful, though.
So have you attended and performed at weddings that cross all of the boundaries, all of the genres of religion?
I have. I've attended weddings that, I haven't been to a Catholic mass at, the Basilica or something like that. I think I'm doing one, however, this or maybe next Saturday. But I have my first Catholic wedding I'll be doing is coming up this week. I've done Native American weddings, you know, where they burn sage and other little herbs and things like that and invoke nature spirits. I've been to weddings where, in addition to me getting up there and playing, songs, you know, typical wedding songs, Always and Forever, things like that. Then the bride and groom at one wedding I did turned right around and they did their dance, their first dance together to a song by the rock group Tool, which was a little different. As a matter of fact, one wedding reception I did, I wasn't actually hired as a musician. This is interesting. They invited me to come out and stay the night for the reception afterward because they rented a very old house in Black Mountain that was believed to be haunted. And they had me come out there. I think this is before I was with Lemur. And they had me come out there with some scientific equipment and cameras and whatnot and try and document the possible haunting that occurred at this place. So, there have been a variety of really strange circumstantial things that were kind of cross-genre in terms of the religions that I've participated in weddings. But I couldn't tell you how many I've actually been to, just too many to count.
So as a guy who has seen so many different wedding ceremonies, do they all just seem kind of silly and boring to you?
Some of them do.
Yeah.
Some of them do. The one exception was my cousin getting married. I was actually just attending as a family member. For once! You know, that's something I'm just not really used to. I didn't know how to handle myself, and so I got a little emotional, and I think it was probably not so much because my cousin was getting married, but because I really just didn't know what to think. I wasn't getting paid anything, and I was at a wedding. No, I'm kidding. Sometimes there is... Oh, I've been to bilingual weddings as well, where they actually had interpreters there. So that was interesting.
Because the bride and groom speak different languages?
No, what the circumstances were there. Yeah, I was hired to play flamenco guitar, flamenco, do the rumba and all these things, it's kind of neat. But the groom was from Spain, and he spoke Spanish and very little English. The bride, who had hired me, spoke fluent Spanish and English, but no one else primarily spoke Spanish. So they actually had my father, who did the wedding, and a minister who spoke both English and Spanish who was interpreting, and they did the entire wedding ceremony in both languages. That was kind of neat. But, having been in so many instances, I don't really know that I feel like it's a I don't know if trivial would be the right word to bring up. I know that's kind of what you were alluding to. I'm a fan of shorter ceremonies, like yours. I remember, man, we were in the door and you were done in 10 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
Forrest and I, we didn't have time to cry that day, you know? But
oh, I did. I was bawling the whole time. No. It was the best day of my life. Please continue.
I think I was done. On that note, I'm done. I get the hint.
No. I actually, we did ours in a very succinct, efficient way. There was a fantastic view of the Blue Ridge Mountains behind us through a massive window, and that was all of the sort of divine sentiment we needed. Your father, of course, is an Episcopal priest, but I, of course, adhere to no particular religion, nor does Lauren. That was no problem for your father, and so everything went very smoothly, and it was just perfect. It was exactly what we needed. Because, you know, when you look at going into the judge's chamber and just standing there before the judge and taking your vows, I mean, that's where, like, rapists stand, you know? That's where murderers stand, and they plead for the mercy or whatever. So it's kind of like, it's a little sterile and a little creepy sometimes to just stand before the judge. Because we went up and we checked out the judge's chamber at the courthouse. And
you just didn't like the smell, huh?
Not the most romantic setting, no, I'm afraid.
I can imagine.
Okay, well, soon we're coming up on our first break, and when we come back from that break, then we're going to tell you the breaking news about what we have been achieving in the Lemur Lab. But first, listen to this. This is a really interesting story. Apparently, it's all true. This is mainstream media. Okay, let me tell you what happened to a 14-year-old boy in Germany yesterday. The boy was standing outside on his way to school. He looked up in the sky and saw this massive fireball smoking and zooming through the sky. So he's watching this in awe. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And all of a sudden, he says, "Oh, crap!" But before he can do anything, guess what?
Boom!
It hits him! This meteorite actually hits this kid. It's going 30,000 miles per hour. After it hits the kid, it hits the ground. All the witnesses said it sounded like a clap of thunder. It left this big smoking furrow about a foot or two long in the earth. And at the end of the furrow is a pea-sized meteorite. Fortunately for the boy, it just cut his hand. It went right through and grazed his hand. And so this boy has now become the second person in recorded history who has actually been hit by a meteorite that has been verified. There was one case in 1954 when a woman in Alabama was apparently in her bedroom. She was sleeping, and a grapefruit-sized meteorite crashed through the roof of her house. And after it smashed through the top of the house, it bounced off furniture and then hit her. So it wasn't a direct hit. It was after bouncing
Ricochet.
Off furniture. Yeah. This kid actually had this pea-sized meteorite tear right by his hand until it hit the ground in this massive display. It kind of reminds me of one of those majestic moments, say, when Superman comes to Earth from the planet Krypton, you know? Imagine standing right there and witnessing this. So, obviously, this meteorite is going to be very valuable. They say that the overwhelming majority of meteors, they just burn up in the atmosphere. And of those that actually hit the Earth, 6 out of 7 hit the ocean. So the chances of actually surviving a direct hit, I mean, even being struck by a meteorite directly, is 1 in 100 million. How do you like those odds? Amazing stuff. Well, when we come back, we're going to continue with the amazing, the remarkable, the extraordinary, the downright weird. That's what we dig into Saturday nights here on this show, keeping you company, 8 to 11 p.m. East Coast time. I'm Joshua P. Warren. And this is Speaking of Strange on News Radio 570 WWNC.
This 570 WWNC podcast is brought to you by Applied Solutions Group, Web solutions and information technology for your business. Visit them at www.appliedtns.com.
Welcome back to Speaking of Strange. I am your host, Joshua P. Warren, in the studio tonight with Forrest Connor and Micah Hanks. And both of them can attest to what has been happening in the Lemur Lab. I told you on last week's show that after much talk, a lot of lead-up, anticipation, and potential fanfare, that we were finally at the point where the Lemur Lab was going to be conducting its first really thorough, official sort of experiment last Tuesday, which I believe was June the 9th. And we weren't sure if we were going to be able to achieve what we were hoping for, but boy, we had some great success. And that is, and no small part, due to, the help of Mobius and also Kuka, who were there at the magical moment when what we were trying to achieve finally manifested. Now, I have hesitated to sort of explain to you what we were trying to do for our first experiment, because it's one of these things that may seem a little too technical at first for some people who just want to listen to the show for pure entertainment value. But nonetheless, let me go ahead and tell you exactly what we did and how all this came to pass. You may know that for around 15 years, a very good friend of mine, a man I consider a mentor, named Charles Yost, allowed me to work with him in his laboratory. And Charles Yost, he was a NASA engineer. He is actually in the NASA Hall of Fame. He is one of the inventors of the memory foam, Tempur-Pedic-type memory foam. And Charles Yost, back in 1995, did a really amazing experiment, and he published the results of it in his journal called Electric Spacecraft. Yost lived here in Western North Carolina, and he had a laboratory in Madison County. He set up a system known as a Schlieren imaging system, also called a Foucault system. And basically, it entails taking a video camera and pointing it at a concave astronomical quality mirror. I'm talking very fine, sharp, clear quality mirror. And you have a pinhole light source that goes into the mirror. And then you have a razor blade you stick into the mix to sort of cut the light waves up. I won't go into all those details, but what you end up with is a video screen that shows you any change in air density between the camera and the mirror. So, for example, if you're looking at a monitor with this system, you can stick your hand in front of the camera and see all the heat boiling off of your hand. He even had video footage he showed me one time when he was doing this, and a common housefly passed through the field of vision. And the housefly had all of this sort of energy boiling off of it like exhaust from a jet. You know, this is how sensitive this thing is. Any change in air density. This type of system was first developed so that aeronautical engineers could see the way air was flowing around wings and airfoils without having to use a wind tunnel. So he wanted to know what the air density looked like when there were electrostatic discharges. And by that, I'm talking about the kind of energy you get if you drag your socks across the carpet on a cold, dry day and touch the doorknob and you get that spark, They go snap. Well, there are machines out there, a Van de Graaff machine, Wimshurst machine, that produces that kind of energy. Well, he took these machines. In fact, he took one, a Wimshurst machine, and hooked it up in front of this imaging system, and he was looking at the way the air behaved when he would get these electrical discharges. And what he found was that on the tip of an electrode, where the energy was coming out from one of these machines, that there was only visible through the Schlieren imaging system what looked to be a little thread of energy that would just shoot out. And at first, when he saw this little thread of energy shooting out, he figured, well, surely I guess this is just, you know, electricity. These are just electrical ions. Well, just like in magnetism, with electricity, a positive charge is attracted to a negative charge, or two positive charges will repel each other, and two negative charges will repel each other, just like the north and south of a magnet will snap together, or two norths will oppose, or two souths will oppose, right? So here we have this stream shooting out of one electrode. So in order to see it, that it was indeed an electrical phenomenon, he brought a wire around from the opposite electrode, fully expecting this stream to sort of warp and bend over to the opposite electrode. Well, guess what? It did not. He could not affect this stream with electricity. So then he got a magnet out, and he put the magnet all around and even through the stream, and that didn't affect it. He tried putting heat below it to see if thermal turbulence would affect it. That did not affect it. He went through everything at his disposal, and he found that this energy that he called a coherent thread-like stream of unknown constitution was emanating from this electrode, but it could not be affected by electricity, magnetism, or anything thermal, and he died never knowing what the explanation for this was. Now, I was so intrigued by this that I decided our first experiment at the Lemur Lab needed to be a reproduction of the coherent thread-like stream, because if it doesn't respond to electricity or magnetism or any of these other things, well, it seems like it's a new form of energy. And LEMUR stands for the League of Energy Materialization and Unexplained Phenomena Research. What a perfect way to start off the lab looking at some type of an energy manifestation that is unexplainable, right? Well, it took us about 10 hours on the first night on June 9th to get everything set up, and sure enough, we reproduced it. Yost was obviously correct. He was accurate. We got the coherent thread-like stream, and I can tell you it's true. This stream of energy, which we have produced now with a Wimshurst and a Van de Graaff, is not affected by electric fields, magnetic fields, thermal turbulence, and furthermore, as far as I know, we are the first team to test radioactive substances to see if that will affect it. Nope, no effect there either. So what is this? We are going to try to create two of them now to see if they will interact with each other. We're going to try to create one in a vacuum to see what happens. We're going to create them at different temperatures, but this is huge. And if we continue getting the same results, then we're going to be able to conclusively say at some point, this is a new form of energy, and we are going to incorporate it into a whole new theory about how the world works, which might actually force physicists who are conscientious to actually go back and re-examine everything they know about the physical sciences. So this has been a very exciting week. And I mentioned earlier I haven't gotten a lot of sleep. That's because every single night since then, I've been back over there at the lab, staying up, doing experiments. And I just barely escaped death last night. Micah, you can attest to that. We have a couple minutes before our break tell me, what are your thoughts on what we've been doing in the lab in just a few days? It's amazing.
Well, I've been really excited. You got death-defying last night is what happened. You know, you I believe we had our Wimshurst set up. You know, we actually have had, and for you laymen out there, we've been using electrostatic generators in the lab to do this sort of stuff, and these aren't that hard to come by. In fact, some of these electrostatic generators you can build. In fact, you could probably take, and I think by definition Josh would agree, you take a PVC pipe and you take a piece of wool and you start creating friction between the two of them, and you can build a static charge. So by definition, that is a very simple electrostatic generator. Now, of course, in terms of engineering, we usually would use a motor fed electricity to generate a static charge. Those are the kinds of generators that we're using, and specifically a Van de Graaff and a Wimshurst generator. Now, Charles Yost used a Wimshurst generator in his experiments with the addition of these two large capacitors that he built out on the negative and positive terminals. Well, last night we had been using primarily the Van de Graaff, which in our experiments we've gotten better results with. And when we hooked up the – actually, I was the one that had said, "Oh, Josh, can we hook up the Wimshurst?" And so you got death-defying, and you started attaching great big capacitors that you had built to the positive and negative terminals on this Wimshurst. And indeed, these things were building up they were building such incredible charges that, we all were keeping our distance from those things, and you for that matter. It was quite scary. But nonetheless, we've managed this very professionally, very carefully. You know, we are trained. We've worked for a long time to get to a point where we could do this kind of thing. And the very first few days have been so promising that I am just thrilled. I can't wait to get back in there. You know, I was in there with you until, 5:15, 5:30 this morning. Mm-hmm. And we're all a little giddy tonight on lack of sleep, but, boy, it's worth it.
It is. And this is just the beginning. We have a list that's pages long of experiments that we're going to do. And guess what? Every time we do one of these crazy, mad scientist-type experiments that could change the world, we are going to report about it first right here on Speaking of Strange. So this show, it's now taking on a whole new dimension that has relevance to science and entertainment. And I'm not exaggerating here. We are taking all of our findings and we are publicizing them freely for the good of humankind into the public domain. It's now time for our break. When we come back, we should have Ed Grimsley with us. He is in California, but he will be in Asheville in a few days. And you've heard me talk about seeing a UFO using night vision equipment. I was so impressed. I said, "Ed, you've got to come to Asheville." And he will be here next weekend. So we're going to talk to Ed and get the latest from him on what you can see with the night vision technology when you're looking for anomalies in outer space. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange.
This 570 WWNC podcast is brought to you by Applied Solutions Group, web solutions and information technology for your business. Visit them at www.appliedtns.com.
Maker of rules, dealing with fools, I can cheat you blind.
Trust me, there is something up there. There is an eye in the sky, and sometimes you can only see it with the proper equipment. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Welcome back to Speaking of Strange. I had to see it to believe it myself when I was in Laughlin, Nevada in February. You've probably heard this story, but I went out there into the desert with the third generation military-grade night vision goggles, and I looked up into the sky, and there was an enormous sort of wedge-shaped formation. And this wedge-shaped formation, it was silent. It was so big, it took up majority of the sky, and it was just slowly gliding from the southeast to the northwest, actually in the direction of Nellis Air Force Base. So I'm not saying these are aliens from beyond. Or maybe if they are aliens from beyond, then they are aliens that are working with Nellis Air Force Base. But either way, it was so profound to see something that is not supposed to be there. And I said to some of these guys who do this, I said to Ed Grimsley, and I said to Dean Worsing. Ed is in California. Dean is in Maryland. Both of them do this. I said, guys, please come to Asheville and let's, you know, I want people to see this for themselves. It's not enough to hear me talking about it. And one of these goggles, one set of these goggles cost $5,000. So these guys are bringing like 10 pairs of these, $50,000 worth of night vision goggles. And this technology is so advanced, you cannot even take it outside of the United States because it's considered a security risk to do so. So anyway, if you want to know all the details, we're going to, you know, do this. We're going to be out there looking at the sky Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Go to joshuapwarren.com, joshuapwarren.com, for all the details on what we're going to be doing. And, you know, I was saying earlier that we were going to try to talk to Ed. Well, Ed's out there in California. Ed has some kind of an event he's doing tonight, so I wasn't sure if he was going to be available. But I do think that Dean Worsing is available. And Dean, he has actually taken this concept of sky watching and really done everything possible to approach it in a very meticulous, pragmatic, scientific way. He has studied the satellites. He has studied the space junk. And he has taken all precautions to rule those things out. And he is going to be, you know, giving a program to everybody who attends the Skywatch so that they can learn how to rule out things that might fool them, right? So, again, Dean is in Maryland, so he's on the East Coast, and we're going to chat with him briefly since he's going to be in Asheville in a few days. Hey, Dean, welcome to the show, my friend.
Hello, Joshua. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, very happy to have you as well. And boy, given all the fun that we had in Sedona, and people who listen to this show, they know exactly who you are because I did a whole show talking about my adventures with you and Ann in Sedona. And now, time flies. Here you are coming to Asheville in a few days, and we're gonna hopefully see some wild stuff down here, huh?
Oh, Joshua, I tell you, I am looking so forward to it. And it's always a surprise when you take these third-generation night vision goggles and you point them up into the sky and you're no longer looking in the visible spectrum that we see things every day with. You're looking in the infrared. So it's like looking into a new dimension, and you just don't know what you're going to see. There's all kinds of stuff up there.
And, of course, one thing that's so exciting about this area is that we already have these strange lights that people see and have seen for hundreds of years around here. In fact, just last night, some of my friends and I hooked up with a couple of guys who used to work at Bell Labs, and they come down to North Carolina every year just to study the Brown Mountain lights. They were up at Brown Mountain Monday night, and they got some of the most incredible photographs I've ever seen from that area. I mean, they got hundreds of pictures of these multicolored spheres of light hovering on and around some of the mountains at Brown Mountain, rising up into the sky. So, I mean, given the fact that we have a region where those types of things also manifest, that just sort of compounds the possibilities for what we might see. So how would you sort of, you know, compare what you've seen in Maryland to what you see when you go to a place like Arizona or Nevada? Are you seeing the same stuff, or does it vary a little from place to place?
Well, Joshua, it actually, it seems that in our night skies, it doesn't matter where you're at. Matter of fact, it just kind of blew my mind. When I was in Laughlin, Nevada with you, I would see the same constellations in the sky that I would see in my backyard in Maryland. So it's like the Earth is big and vast, but East Coast to West Coast is not that big in comparison to what we see in space. In other words, even though we are changing our viewpoint, pretty much you see the same night sky. But I see activity regardless of where I go. And my presentation, you know, we explore what a bat looks like, what a bird looks like, what a lightning bug looks like. And then the rest of the presentation is phenomena that I can't explain. It is literally UFOs, unidentified flying objects. And these things react to lasers. They light up and change altitude. They seem to get smaller and go to outer space. And then we see the typical things like satellites and probably space junk and planes. But there's something here. There's something going on in our night skies, and it probably doesn't matter where you are on the globe. You're going to witness this with these third-generation night vision goggles. Now, I know you've talked to you've talked about this on the radio before, about the V formation that you, I, and Will and my son saw in Laughlin, Nevada. Now, that was a real treat, and that's completely unexplainable, and I would love to be on top of a mountain in Asheville and get that V formation on film for once and for all. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You just said something so amazing. You said they respond to a laser. Now, tell us more about that.
Well, we have a phenomenon where, well, first let me back up and tell you a little bit about how we do these night watches. Typically what I'll do is I'll wear a couple hats. What I'll do is I'll be the spotter to find them for people, and I'm also filming at the same time so that you can get the group's attention on what you're looking at. We highlight it with a green laser, and everybody can see the green laser through the night vision goggles really well. So everybody else that has goggles can kind of tune in where you're looking. But there's a weird phenomenon where when we hit it with the laser, sometimes they will change course, which space junk and satellites cannot do.
No.
Yeah. So to the observer on Earth, sometimes it's a minute change, but it is a change that we can document and see. And it's really important as an observer sometimes when you do see something, kind of track the direction it's going in. Maybe pick out a star in front of it that it looks like it's going to go exactly to. And then when you hit it with the laser, you can tell if there's deviations off that course. And I have things like that on film that I just can't explain. I don't know what they are.
Well, okay, we got to take a break here. And can you stick around through the break to finish up the hour with me?
Absolutely.
Okay, great, because I want to talk a little bit more about some of the simple techniques that you have devised to rule out satellites. And this is information that's not just valuable when you are out there in the field doing a formal sky watch with, you know, $5,000 goggles. This is stuff that's valuable for anybody who is out there looking at the skies, trying to determine if some strange light is a UFO or something conventional. And there are all kinds of little, you know, basic things that you can remember, that you can learn, that you can employ right at the moment when you see something unusual without needing to pull your little toolkit out. So we're going to get into that when we come back. I'm talking right now with Dean Worsing. Dean is going to be here in Asheville along with Ed Grimsley. Coming up next Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, it's a three-night event starting at AB Tech. And we are going to be out there with the technology looking at the skies. And I have never met anybody who has gone out with these guys and done this. And not seen a UFO, honestly. You may have heard George Norrie talk about it. He went out and he saw a UFO for the first time in his life. So JoshuaPWarren.com has got details if you're interested. When we come back, more with Dean Worsing on Speaking of Strange.
This 570 WWNC podcast is brought to you by Applied Solutions Group. Web solutions and information technology for your business. Visit them at www.appliedtns.com.
Coming at you live from the land of the sky, Asheville, North Carolina. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Welcome back to the final minutes of Hour 1 on tonight's Speaking of Strange. We're talking about UFOs, and not just the kind you can see if you look up at the sky, but the amazing display you see when you watch the sky through third-generation military-grade night vision goggles. In fact, you know, last night was a pretty clear night here in Asheville, and I looked up at the sky, and I could see a decent patch, pretty broad patch, and it looked like maybe there were 50, 60 stars. And yet, when you look at the sky through the night vision goggles, you see, you know, about a 40-degree, relatively small patch of the sky, and it's just packed with hundreds of stars. You see that the entire Earth appears to be surrounded by billions of pinpoints of light when you're looking up through these. And so that's why you're able to see these craft wherever they are, however large they may be, when you use this technology. I'm talking with Dean Worsing. He will be here in Asheville in a few days, along with Ed Grimsley, for the Asheville Sky Fishing Extravaganza. And so, Dean, for just anybody who wants to go out there and look up at the sky and watch for UFOs, what is a basic rule? What's a basic tip you can pass along about how someone can make sure they are not mistaking a common satellite for something truly extraordinary?
Good point. And we'll go over that quite a bit in the talk, and I'll give you some good indicators right here that we can use as a foundation in scientific method that'll help us determine how fast something's moving. But I wanted to bring up a point before the break. You talked about how expensive these goggles are, and you know it's a luxury that most people aren't willing to go out and spend, and that's why it's such a great thing to get these groups of people together where we can just pass these goggles around. And these events are so much fun. They're just a fantastic time. And it's if there's not clouds in the sky, we always see something that blows our mind. But basically, as an observer on Earth, you have to throw out a couple things. One is speed. There's no good, intelligent way for me to tell you how fast something is moving, like miles per hour. The second thing is, I can't tell you the altitude of it. I can't tell you how high it is because I don't know how big it is. So when I started researching all this, I said, you know what, I just got to throw that stuff out the window. Forget about it. But astronomers have been using tools since the beginning of time, since man has been stargazing, that have helped people figure out what's going on in our night skies. And one thing that's a big tell is the degree in change. Now, if you take horizon to horizon on Earth, it's basically 180 degrees. It's a half circle. And we know that low-orbiting satellites travel between 90 and 100 minutes. They'll do a full orbit around the Earth. So basically, if it's going 100 minutes, it's going 3.6 degrees a minute. So that kind of gives us some foundation in science where we can go, okay, well, this is what satellites do. Well, how about this thing? Why is it moving 3 and 4 times faster than that? So that's kind of how we're approaching this. And they're cruel tools, but they're good tools. I think they do a good job for us.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the idea that just understanding how big the space is you're looking at and how quickly conventional things should move across that space allows you to rule them out. And it's not that difficult once you see some examples.
Mm-hmm.
So now we only have a couple minutes left here. Tell me about one of the strangest things that you've seen so far using this method.
Well, I tell you, every time I see this, and it's not super uncommon, but it always blows my mind, and that is this. A lot of times we'll see an object traveling along, we'll hit it with a laser, and they have a tendency to light up. They might get 3, 4, 10 times brighter than they are when we originally see them. And when you see this, it usually means there's an altitude change, that they're shooting off to outer space. And lo and behold, right before your eyes, you'll see this thing brighten up and get extremely bright, and then you'll see it just shrink down and get smaller, smaller, and smaller. And that always is validation for me that we got something going on.
Yeah, really. And, of course, it makes you wonder, why do they run from the lasers?
Well, you know, Mobius and I have talked about this, and if Ed is correct, that if there's battles going on and they destroy each other with lasers, I'm sure they have laser detection skin or something.
I mean,
some way to tell that they're being pointed by a laser. So they might just say, let's get out of here, you know, as soon as they have a laser pointed at them.
Yeah, good
point. Not sure. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are out of time. Dean, I cannot wait to see you in a few days. Thanks so much for being on the program tonight. And when we return, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to have Angela Moore with us. She was the first guest on the first edition of Speaking of Strange over 5 years ago.